Town, bought some weed from the patty shop by the Polo Grounds projects, stopped at Willie's Burgers on 145th, and then jetted back to Long Island, where I introduced Havoc, Carrie, Money No, Dirty Harry, and some of my other friends. Later that night, we went to White Castle, the after-hours hangout in Hempstead. It had just started raining, and Hav asked me if he could drive my car around the block. We were drunk and high, so even though I knew Hav never driven a car before, I let him. This kid Kevin, who lived around the corner from me, went with him just in case. I watched Hav circle around one time, and then another, and then he hit the gas too hard when he tried pulling back into the parking lot and almost drove into White Castle. Luckily, he ran over a fire hydrant instead. My car was stuck on top of the hydrant. When I snapped out of shock, six of us pushed the car off the hydrant and hurried up out of there before the cops came. My brand new imported Sterling sputtered like a moped. "I'm sorry, son," Hav kept saying. "I'm gonna pay for it, don't worry." I didn't care because I didn't have to work hard to get that car anyway. We laughed it off. Although it wasn't nothing funny about it, I had the car for 2 weeks and was already back to riding the Iron Horse. If you don't know, that's the train. 2 weeks later, I got my car back from the repair shop, but it never really drove the same. Hav and I came up with a name for our group, the Poetical Prophets. Around that same time, my man Carrie called and gave me my new name, Prodigy. As soon as I heard it, I was like, "That's it. That's me. I'm running with that." Hav's cousin Todd took our photos. My brother Greg had a new camera he was proud of, so he took some pictures of us too. Hav agreed to let my moms be our manager, and we were ready. We had pictures, a manager, and a 50-song demo. We kept cutting school, except now we were walking to record labels all over Manhattan, hoping to be heard. We looked on the back of rap albums, got the office address to labels, and stood outside until we saw rappers coming and going. Def Jam was our first pick. While waiting by the front door, this rap group, the Afros, walked out. I approached them with my Walkman and asked them to listen to the music. "Ain't got time for that, shorty," they said, and kept walking. Fuck them niggas. One afternoon, we saw Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest by the office on Elizabeth Street in Houston. He was cool. He stopped, put our headphones on, and gave one of our songs a listen. It was 1989, and there were no young rappers with lyrical content like ours. Hav and I made graphic, reality-based hood music. There was nothing like us at that time. We had Q-Tip open. "Yo, I'm gonna take you inside and introduce you to some people," he said. He brought us inside Def Jam on the spot and introduced us to the entire office. He was the first person in the industry to recognize our talent and give us a chance. Q-Tip even helped us set up a meeting with Russell Simmons and Leo Cohen, the president and owner of the label. We were excited. We felt like that was our past. We were coming to Def Jam every day now. The next day, we went to school and stayed the entire day. We hadn't spent a whole day of school in like 4 months. There were signs on the bulletin board for a school talent show. You know we signed up. We only liked school because of the girls and robbing students for their goods. Plus, that's where our friends were at. We got drunk and high right before class mostly every day when we actually stayed. We were terrors in that school. We did a lot of things I can't discuss because it would incriminate us. But we ran through that school like we owned it. Hav and I were pissy drunk at talent show practice one day, drinking 40s of Ballantine Ale and OE. Hav was more bent than me. He told me how he and our boy from school, Derek, were planning to set me up and rob me when Derek first introduced us. but they ended up feeling my style, so they changed their minds. Wow, crazy. I guess the truth does come out when you're drunk. After the rehearsal, somebody in the crowd of 10 people started clapping and making a lot of noise for our song. Aw, shit. When I got a good look, to my surprise, it was my pops. I was happy as hell to see him, and Hav was too. Pops told me Grandma's was letting him hide out at her new condo on Roosevelt Island, right across the water from our school. My pops, man, it felt real good to see him. I was excited about my new career as a rapper and told my pops we had a meeting with Russell Simmons in a couple of days. He was happy for us. We walked around Manhattan for a few hours and rode the tram by 59th Street Bridge to my grandmother's luxury condo in Roosevelt Island. We talked mostly about music, but he asked me about my health and explained that he was on the run again for guns and drugs. I gotta be careful about how I move around, he said. Pops told me that since he been staying at Grandma's spot, he see me more often. Cool. I was happy to see my pops. I ain't seen him in a long time. I rode back from the island alone and went home. A couple of days later, it was meeting time. We changed DJs from Tafari to Haz Man Prince AD from Queensbridge. Tafari was like 6'1", and Prince AD was real little like us. He fit in. We were scheduled to meet Russell Simmons at his Manhattan condo around the block from Def Jam. I always kept my gun on me, but I didn't want to disrespect Russell by bringing that type of energy into his home. So this kid Perry at Def Jam let me leave it in his office drawer until we were done. Perry walked us to Russell's apartment on Broadway near NYU. Russell's assistant let us in. There was a big-ass jacuzzi tub in the floor in the room next to the living room. The white carpet had just been shampooed, and we had to take our shoes off and step in the soapy, stinking carpet in wet socks. Oh, so this is what it's like to have $1 million in your own record label. Nervous and excited, we waited around for 15 minutes until the assistant said Russell wasn't going to be able to make it. He sent us back to the office to meet with Leo Cohen instead. Leo listened to our best songs and told us that we cursed too much and our music was too violent. He said Def Jam couldn't do anything with us because we were too young to speak like that. He said they would get in trouble with the law for putting out our album. What? We couldn't believe it. We were pissed off. But we weren't that mad because we knew we had some hot shit. If they didn't sign us, it was their loss. Not ours. Although a month later, they signed the group Onyx from Jamaica, Queens. These niggas was screaming, cussing, and waving Tech Nines in the videos, looking like black skinheads. As we were leaving Def Jam, I went to get my gun from Perry's office. We walked in behind him, and Perry passed it to Hav instead of me. I asked him for some De La Soul and Slick Rick posters I seen lying around, and he went to get them. Hav pointed the gun at me, playing around. You don't play with me like that, man, I told him. When our friend came back with the posters, Hav pointed the gun at him. Nigga, give me them posters, Hav said, joking. The gun went off, hitting Perry in the stomach, his shirt catching fire with a bullet hit as he fell onto me. Hav dropped the gun and ran out the building with Prince AD right behind him. Yo, this nigga just shot this motherfucker. I looked down at Perry as he tried to grab onto my shoulder. Yo, get off of me. I yanked my arm away from him. I'm going with my people. I ran downstairs to catch up with Hav and AD. The most popular duo in rap, Run DMC, was walking into the building as Hav, Prince AD, and I came running out. My boys knocked them to the ground as they busted out the front door and ran up Houston towards Broadway to the train station. I wasn't far behind. Stop those kids! Somebody screamed behind us. When I looked back, it was Ali Shaheed Muhammad, the DJ from A Tribe Called Quest. Havoc stopped running and started screaming at me.
Yo, I didn't mean it, son. I didn't mean to shoot him. You gotta hide me, son. Take me to Florida.
I saw some detectives riding past us in an unmarked car and told Hav to be quiet. The three D's got out the car and came over to us.
Is there a problem?
One of the officers asked. Havoc started screaming again.
I didn't mean to shoot him. It was an accident, man.
The D's pulled out cuffs and put them on Hav. Ali Shaheed Muhammad caught up with us and told the cops what happened. I told them that it was an accident. We thought it was a lighter. We found it outside. We didn't know it was a real gun. They took Hav to the bookings. Prince A.D. and I went home. The next morning, Moms woke me up for school. She had the radio on Kiss FM as usual. While we were both getting dressed, they announced that some rappers got into an argument with Leo Cohen at Def Jam over contracts, and one of the rappers, Kiwan Muchita, shot an A&R because they didn't sign us.
What?
I explained the real story to my moms.
I have to go see the dude in the hospital to make sure he's okay and to make sure he knows how it went down, I said.
I felt bad because we had just met the kid through Q-Tip. Perry showed us love, helping us get inside Def Jam instead of us having to stand outside like groupies. But my main focus was getting Perry to agree to tell the story to help Hav get out of trouble. My mom said she'd come with me. So after school, we went to see him. My mother felt more badly for him than I did. Dude was messed up bad. The bullets were covered in green mold, causing an infection in his intestines. They had to take them out and let them heal outside of his body so the infection wouldn't spread. They attached a shit bag to his body while his intestines healed. Listen, I'm here for a reason, I said, sitting beside his bed. This is what you gotta say so Havy doesn't have to go to jail. We found it outside the office. We thought it was a lighter. We didn't realize it was a gun. Say, yeah, that's true. I was there when they found it, and they thought it was a lighter. Perry was our man, so he knew it was just an accident. Hav beat the charges in court. After that, Def Jam got security guards. Big muscle-bound dudes at the front door. Wow, we were setting trends in the game already. When my 16th birthday came around, my moms bought me The Autobiography of Malcolm X by Alex Haley, the same guy who wrote Roots. I never had the patience to read a 500-page book before. But after the first 50 pages, I realized that Malcolm X was a street dude before he became a great speaker and leader. Plus, Malcolm was once a part of the Nation of Islam, and I wanted to learn more about the 120 lessons of Islam. It took me 2 weeks to read, opened my eyes, and planted the seed in my brain. I still had a lot to learn, but I felt a change in my mentality coming, a drastic change. Havoc and I started recording at this new spot, 510 Studios, on South Franklin in Hempstead. Paul, the guy who ran it, and his partner Kerwin, the in-house engineer, both made beats and had a similar style to Public Enemy's producer, Hank Shockley. Paul and Kerwin loved our style and wanted to produce a whole album for us, so we got to use the studio all the time. A lot of big names in rap music come from Long Island. Rakim, Biz Markie, EPMD, De La Soul, Public Enemy, Method Man, Busta Rhymes, and myself. I was proud to represent Hempstead. But I'm glad my moms got me out of there and moved to Queens because I was exposed to a different way of living. The first 16 years of my life were incredible, but the next 16 would be nothing short of history book material. October 10th, 2008, Mid-State Correctional Facility. Marcy, New York.
Marcy, New York. Marcy, New York. Marcy, New York.
8 a.m.
8 a.m.
The dorm I was in at Mid-State Correctional Facility held 30 inmates from all walks of life. Ex-cops, judges, DAs, school superintendents, COs, a couple of bloods, and a multi-millionaire who ran Tyco and had an ownership stake in the Yankees and the Yes, Yankees Entertainment Station Network. A real motley crew, mostly white men in their late 40s. My homeboy Young, one of the few inmates I was close with, was 22 and serving 5 years for criminal enterprise. We laugh about how almost all the white inmates in our dorm had to take psychiatric medication because they couldn't deal with the reality of being in prison. They actually believed that they didn't belong here or should have received lighter sentences or gotten away with their crimes completely, that they were too good to be serving time because of their upbringing, academic background, or resumes. It was hilarious to sit back and analyze them. It made me appreciate being raised on both sides of the tracks. I know what it's like to live in the hood with poverty and in the suburbs with money. So I'm comfortable among savage street mentalities and highbrow squares. I prefer a savage mind over a square one, because without money, expensive houses and safe neighborhoods, cars, and the other materialism that gives a false sense of security in their little fake-ass world, a square couldn't survive in the real world, with poverty and savages a king. Just imagine for a moment, the apocalypse hits. Armageddon, Babylon, the corporate world is falling. No electricity, bank accounts, gas stations, no calling 911 because there's no phone service. Who will survive longer, if at all? Mr. and Mrs. Square-Ass Lame with their master's degrees and their Prada suits? Or Mr. and Mrs. Savage Mentality who are used to having nothing and are close friends with all the neighborhood criminals? I suggest you read the Book of Revelations if you're confused about the answer. Having a savage mentality doesn't necessarily make you an evil person. It just means that you have a set of survival skills that can be used if needed. There are a lot of people who use it in a negative way. I used to be one of them. But while serving these 3 years in prison, I practiced keeping a very peaceful state of mind. For those of you who can relate, once you master that level of self-control, you'll notice your life start to drastically improve. It will help you avoid a world of unnecessary trouble. I wish I could have learned this on the streets at 16 instead of in prison at 33, but my life didn't play out that way. In late January 1990, right after the new year rolled around, my mother woke me up to go to school at 6:40 a.m. I don't know what got into me that morning. I'm not going to school no more, I told my mom flat out. She thought I was just talking in my sleep and tried to get me up again 5 minutes later. I'm not going to school no more, I told her again. I'm going back to sleep. Okay, Mom said, and left for work. That was that. I did eventually go to school again, but it wasn't to go inside. I park out front and kick it with the females at Art and Design, then do the same at the all-girls Catholic school down the street called Cathedral. The Cathedral girls walk past our school to get to the train station in their miniskirt uniforms. When I eventually succeeded at getting the Cathedral girl, it was like a dream come true. Her name was Jade, a real pretty 17-year-old dark-skinned dime with green chinky eyes from Harlem, whose parents owned a brownstone by Convent Ave. After a week, I had a cut in school to take rides in the Sterling, park, smoke weed, and get busy in the back seat. She was the first girl who would just pull her panties to the side so we could do it with her outfit on. After 3 or 4 episodes with Jade, her phone number was changed. I never went back to Cathedral or Art and Design after that. Not even the school girls. After Jade, I was on a mission. All I wanted was sex with the finest dimes. Chapter 3.
Chapter 3. Chapter 3.
Mobb Deep.
Mobb Deep. Mobb Deep. Mobb Deep. Mobb Deep.
Try to keep a positive mind and walk a straight line don't work. Some niggas is forced to do dirt. Ain't God made dirt, so this dirt won't hurt. Shook Ones, Part 1. 1991. Havoc and I decided to change our name from Poetical Prophets to Mobb Deep. We needed something that described how we were living. When all the QB niggas got together to hang out, there would be like 30 to 40 of us, like a mob. The slang we used when we saw a whole bunch of guys together was, yo, them niggas is deep. Both words together sounded good. Mobb Deep. I decided to use two B's because it just looked better with the extra B. It made it look even. I was a high school dropout, full-time rapper, stick-up kid. It wasn't long before Havoc dropped out too. I was still doing my grand larceny thing. Sold my Sterling for $3,000 and bought my second car, a used Acura Legend, from the same car lot on Hillside Avenue. I paid $9,000 cash, of course. Then took it to Earl Shibe on Peninsula Boulevard in Hempstead and got it painted money green. At Big Boy Toys on Queens Boulevard, they put in white seats with money green piping, a white dashboard, a Momo steering wheel, and green window tints. To top it off, I put hammers on it. Those is rims. I was 16 with the illest car. I was on a rampage. My daily schedule was to buy a bunch of weed uptown, then drive around every borough bagging broads. My man Dirty Harry, who lived around the corner in Hempstead, bought a BMW 5 Series, burgundy with gold trimming, 5-star gold rims, and a burgundy rag top. We used to stare at that car outside the used car lot on Jamaica Avenue. I'm buying that shit, Harry would say. And he damn sure did. Harry was my closest friend from Hempstead. He lived on the corner of my block, and we'd known each other since diapers. My father used to date his moms way back in the day. So Harry and I were like brothers. I stashed all my dirty money in his crib. $30,000 to $40,000. You know that's your homie when you could trust him with that much dough. Dirty Harry had a friend named Money No. Money No would thug him out for the new car Harry just bought. That's borrow it and bring it back when he felt like it. Money No and I ended up getting real cool. Harry and Money No had some old beef with each other and would fist fight constantly. So I couldn't even chill with both of them at the same time. Maybe it was because Money No's father also used to date Carrie's moms. But every Tuesday night, we'd hang out at the rink, a popular roller skating rink in Teaneck, New Jersey. Man, that was the spot. We'd race the Beamer and the Acura from Hempstead to Teaneck in 15 minutes flat. Havoc, Prince AD, Hav's brother TJ, and sometimes Carrie would ride in my Acura, and Money No had his crew in the BMW. Even if we didn't go inside the rink, the parking lot across the street was a party in itself, packed with females and niggas in their prized possession, their cars. Dudes walked around the lot selling drugs and temporary licenses for $100. I bought like 3 of those. Inside, the rink was filled with females from all over the tri-state. Everybody who was anybody was there every Tuesday. It was smaller and more exclusive than the popular Skate Key rink in the Bronx. You had to be in the know. I bumped into one of Hav's boys from QB, Yammy, a few times, and we got real cool. He was a drug dealer and a Golden Gloves boxer from Brownsville, Brooklyn, who moved to Queensbridge. Yammy was famous in the streets of New York, an official ghetto superstar. DJ Clark Kent would pass by us in the rink and in the parking lot with our cars and jewelry and say, "You little niggas gonna blow up one day." He didn't even know we was rappers. He just saw how expensive we looked. Most of the sex I was having at 16 came from hanging out at the roller rink and a small spot in Harlem called Ebony Lounge that had an older, well-dressed crowd with some good-looking females and minks and foxes. Derek's homeboy from the Bronx, DJ Damage, played there. We were the youngest in the 21 and over spot with our fake IDs, big jewelry, and nice cars. The ladies were all over me, taking turns pinching my butt as I walked through the crowd. Harlem girls got a lot of style, and I wasn't shy about approaching an older woman. We always arrived dressed fresh, pele-pele leather jackets and all sorts of colors and patterns, a different one for every night. The older dudes in the spot wanted to kill us, rob us, and both, because we were taking their ladies. But we never had fear in our hearts. We would party anywhere, and we always had guns, so we didn't give a fuck. I had guns galore, and I kept buying new ones, adding to my collection, different ones for different occasions, little ones to sneak into parties, and big ones in the engine of my Acura for crews that like jumping people outside of parties. We were very well protected from anything that might pop off. At Ebony Lounge one night, this older female named Tanya, around 26 and wearing a gray mint coat, started buying me Amaretto sours and other sweet drinks I never heard of. She was a nurse from the Bronx who worked at a hospital on the Grand Concourse by Fordham Road, a few blocks from Derek crib. She was in love with me. Some nigga Tanya used to mess with would come to the spot every week with his friends to stalk her. I was grinding up on Tanya while she was sucking on my ear in front of the dude to let him know what time it was. Later on, posted up on the wall next to the DJ table with Derek and Money No, I saw the guy at the bar arguing with Tanya. Then he stormed out. "I think you should leave," Tanya came over to warn me. "He's talking about robbing y'all when y'all go outside." Ha! We laughed and kept partying. When we walked out the spot, the dude and six of his friends were standing on the corner watching Money No and me say peace to our people before getting in my car parked across the street. I grabbed my gun from under the seat and stood outside my ride with it clearly in my hand. The dudes whispered and walked away. Clowns, I thought. Dudes mad cause a little nigga took his chick. Tough shit. Money No and I bounced to the Bronx to meet Tanya and her sister at her crib. Sitting on the couch in their living room, Money No and I was smirking at each other as Tanya served us drinks cause the apartment was tore up from the flow up. But those big asses Tanya and her sister had made us not care. Money No went to her sister's room, and Tanya started giving me head right there on the couch. After 30 minutes, her sister called Tanya into the bedroom, and Money No came into the living room, telling me that her sister and Tanya both had their period, but still wanted to sex us. No thank you. I got caught my first time, and it fucked me up for life. Never, ever again. "Pete, look," Money No said, pointing at the floor as we sat on the couch. Gun in my pocket just in case. I didn't see anything. "You don't see all them roaches?" I looked again. There was hundreds of them. As we were inspecting the roach population, a rat ran across the room. "Oh, shit!" We both jumped on the couch screaming. We said our goodbyes real quick. Driving across the Triborough Bridge on the way back to Hempstead, a big roach crawled across the dashboard as if to say, "Sup, y'all?" We pulled over at the first exit, took our clothes off, and shook them out in the street, jumping around like idiots. That was the first and last time we went to Tanya crib. We were having the time of our lives, superstars before we were superstars. Money knows, and my favorite thing to do was drive to Philadelphia for the Greek festival. There was a lot of little niggas our age with money in Philly, riding around with four-wheelers, dirt bike motorcycles in the street, and through the park. Thousands of young people partying in the park, showing off cars, motorcycles, clothes, and females showing off their bodies. Sweet. In late autumn, Kid Capri threw a big party in Manhattan's Upper West Side. Derek and his Bronx crew told me to meet them there, so I scooped Money No and headed to the city.